Hello, everybody. Hello, I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. And happy summer. It's the second day of summer in most parts of the world, I think. And where I am, it's hot. And I'm loving it. I hope you are too, wherever you may be. We'll talk a little bit more about summer in the second part of the program. And we'll be talking, of course, about my favorite subject, food. And it'll be a delicious time, I promise. I don't want to bring up any sad stories about food today. We're going to talk about happy food. But in the first part, we're going to talk about shoes again. I'm kind of into vegan shoe discussions lately because I think it's important. And we have a very special guest, Annie Mohaupt, the founder and CEO of Mohaupt, a Chicago-based footwear manufacturer. Mohaupt combines advanced 3D fabrication technologies with traditional artisanal techniques to produce custom on-demand shoes for women and men. Mohaupt has been featured in Inc. magazine, Entrepreneur.com, Huffington Post, and the Science Channel, and has been recently named both a national top 10 hardware startup and top 10 woman-led startup. Annie, welcome.
Hello.
Great to be here. Hi. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks. How are you?
Good. So I have a friend who told me about your shoes. Whenever I see her, she's always sticking her feet in front of me, saying, look at my new shoes. I just love them. And that's how I found you.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, Robin's really awesome. So we're happy to make shoes for her.
Yeah, she has a lot of vegan energy and a lot of passion for all things vegan. She gets very excited when she finds new things that she loves. And we all should. So I'm kind of fascinated about what you do. I watched the video that was on your website. And so let's talk about shoes. How did you learn how to make shoes and why?
Yeah, well, I just started almost on a whim, actually. My background's in architecture. And when I was in architecture school, I really loved it because we got to make things with our hands. We got to make models, and it's such a great, fun, collaborative environment. But then when I went out in the real world, I was just doing kind of drafting, and I liked the career, but I really missed working with my hands. And I was doing a house renovation at the time. We had all sorts of woodworking equipment in the basement, and I was like, I wonder if I can make shoes with this stuff. So I just decided, like, let's see if I can make shoes. And the first ones were really, really awful. But after literally a couple years of trial and error, I kind of figured out how to make really comfy shoes. So
did you do this all on your own, or did you take any shoe-making training classes?
I did not take any classes. Part of the reason is my initial shoe design was very kind of architecturally inspired. I was inspired by the work of these architects named Charles and Ray Eames and their experimentation with plywood and using kind of like several layers of plywood together to mold two or three dimensional items. And so I started using those sorts of techniques in. The problem was when I would run into roadblocks in designing shoes around that, but it was such an absolutely weird way to make shoes that it really had nothing to do with traditional shoemaking at the time. So I just kind of invented my own techniques really around like kind of architectural and industrial design processes. But I like the way in hindsight, I'm glad I did that because it really led me to some breakthroughs that I wouldn't have accomplished if I, you know, was just like, well, this is the right way to make shoes and I'm going to make shoes this way. I think there's a lot of fun and a lot to be learned and just kind of experimenting and seeing what works and what kind of new techniques you can bring to the table.
I love this. I had no idea. And I'm just delighted to hear how you learned how to make shoes. You know, I support education and training, and there's a lot that we can discover by taking classes and not having to recreate the wheel, as they say. But sometimes not knowing and just looking from within and creating, you come up with something amazing.
Yeah, so, but, I mean, I definitely... Oh, yeah, I agree totally in the foundation of training, and I have a lot of, like, shoemaker friends now who are absolutely horrified that I did not take any instruction. And in hindsight, yeah, I could definitely see that that it was kind of a crazy way to do things, but once in a while it kind of works out. But definitely, you know, even as an architect, I certainly wouldn't want, like, an untrained architect to be like, oh, I just thought, you know, this looks cool here. And, you know, I mean, there's important things, you know, even with shoes, structure, and, you know, they have to protect your feet and, you know, not give you, like, bad knees or anything like that. Like, it really is a quality of life issue that the shoes need to be comfortable and they need to not hurt your feet or give you any blisters or even worse, you know, actual problems with walking or whatever, because there are some shoes that really can mangle your feet. So
absolutely. Well, important. I think the ones that are most focused on crazy fashions, tight, pointy toes, making our feet look smaller than they are, those are the ones that are really problematic. I don't think we really know what the ideal support is for a foot, and maybe it is very individually based, because I'm constantly reading about new running shoes and new concepts. You know, we should have cushion, we shouldn't have cushion, we should go barefoot, we shouldn't. And so I don't think we've heard the last word on that.
Yeah, I agree completely. I do a lot of research into that as well. And there's this kind of the kind of barefoot movement versus, like, you need, like, great arch support. And right now, because my feet are pretty flat, a lot of our shoes have, like, really good arch support. But I've definitely read that that even, like, tennis shoes and stuff are actually not that great for your feet, because they're just kind of like these, like, cushioned tombs, you know, when your foot really can't move naturally. They're just kind of, like, encased. So I try and not do that either, and try to figure out how to allow the foot to move naturally. But I agree 100%. There's a lot of, like, kind of conflicting research into what is the best solution, and it probably does boil down to what's best for individuals, or, you know, wearing, you know, just varying the sorts of shoes that you wear, like not wearing the, you know, obviously wearing, like, 5-inch heels every single day is not a good choice, but
not, you know, a good choice. Women, listen, it's not a good choice. I mentioned this, I think last week, but my sister, who's a commercial real estate attorney, she had won some recognition award where she lives in South Florida. And when she got up to make a very brief presentation talking about how she succeeded, her response was she wore men's shoes. She went faster in men's shoes. And I don't think we necessarily need to wear men's shoes, but we need to wear shoes that are comfortable and not, you know, crazy.
Yeah, I agree. Although we do make 5-inch heels, and I do like wearing them, but I just don't wear them, you know, every day. So I'll go, if I'm wearing my 5-inch heels that we make, I'll wear them, you know, 4 or 6 hours, usually not, like, for an entire day of running around. I try and get a balance.
I'm looking at one of them, but it's not really a 5-inch slope, is it? Because the front has a platform too, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's more like a 3.5-inch slope, and it has actually, like, arch support. I think they're one of the very few shoes that you can get high but still have arch support and still have a lot of cushioning and all that. So, like, most 5-inch heels or very high heels have, like, a metal spike that runs through the heel. So when you're hitting the ground, like, your weight is kind of traveling through this metal spike and hitting the ground. So they're very, like, hard to wear, and there's no give to the shoe, no shock absorption, versus our shoes are made out of wood, and wood is a fantastically shock absorbing material. That's why people would have, like, hardwood floors in their house, or why chefs you so often see wearing clogs. So our shoes are, like, way less fatiguing for that sort of height. They really are, I think, a lot better for your feet.
Yeah, I never really thought about that, but wood does absorb better. I like to do yoga more on a wood floor than on a concrete floor. I know why.
Yep.
Silly things. We learn on this program, and not so silly things. Did you make up the phrase cushion tombs, or did you get that from somewhere? I loved it, and I'm stealing it.
What was the phrase?
Cushion tombs. When you were talking about tennis shoes, you called them cushion tombs.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I believe I might have gotten that from an article I read a long time ago that was by a podiatrist talking about how tennis shoes aren't necessarily all that great. I can't remember if he used the phrase tomb or not, but that was definitely the impression that I came away with from the article.
I love it. Yeah, I'm using it. Okay, now another thing that I love is you use a combination of 21st century machinery, robotic machinery, but at the same time your products are artisanal and handcrafted. So can you talk about the combination of the two?
Yeah, the combination is in a lot of ways just kind of a necessity, a byproduct of our processes. In my background in architecture and in studio, I learned a lot about using new and emerging processes such as 3D printing. We use a machine called a CNC machine that's kind of like a 3D printer, and laser cutters and things like that. There's a lot of stuff that this machinery can do that is better than what the human hand can do. But there's so many more details that I can put in the shoes that just wouldn't be possible entirely by hand. That said, shoes, at this point, technology has not evolved so that shoes can really entirely be made by a machine, except for, say, like Crocs, which are just kind of molded in one form. But your average shoe, for example, has 60 to 70 different components and 60 to 70 different steps. So that's a lot of labor, a lot of work, which is why 98% of shoes are produced abroad. The problem with that is that there tends to be a lot of like human rights abuses in the supply chain. And you have, even though companies, I do believe that there are major companies that are trying to be responsible. However, the infrastructure and the system, in particularly like developing countries, just aren't really set up to avoid exploitation. It's just kind of part of the system right now. So what I am trying to do is incorporate a lot more automated and robotic processes so that we can take out a lot of the labor in shoemaking. So that, you know, ideally teenagers, instead of having to go to work at shoe factories, can go to school and that sort of thing. So for me, mm-hmm. a lot of the automation that I'm really excited about is really about human rights and welfare, and trying to get rid of this current mass system of mass production that we have. So the mass production has brought us a lot of great things in the world, but it's also brought us a lot of exploitation. So what I'm trying to do with my business is take out the exploitative processes from shoemaking. And so basically that means removing a lot of the labor. So our shoes right now have a lot fewer components and a lot fewer steps that can, and those components and steps can be done with automated machinery. But that said, there still has to be a human hand involved in making a great pair of shoes. Just because there's so many materials in a pair of shoes, you need to have materials that are supportive, some materials that are stiff, some that are really soft. The shoe itself has to serve a lot of functions in terms of protection from the elements and being comfortable and supportive and all that stuff. So that's kind of what I'm working on is removing as much labor as possible right now in order to avoid exploitation, but also provide a better product for customers. So these automated processes that we use, we can actually take what is now a 2D scan of your foot and we convert that to a 3D model. And then we digitally carve the footbed to your exact foot shape.
And the great thing about the robotic processes that we use is that we can actually do that. It's impossible to make one-off shoes with mass production, but with robots, we can, for essentially similar, at a similar price point, create one-off shoes, but at like kind of mass production price points.
Well, I applaud you for everything you're doing. It's you want every business to think through all of that and make a product that makes the world a kinder, better place. So your products, I'm scanning the women's shoes right now, and they're really cute. There are clogs and sandals. You're a Chicago-based business. What shoes are you going to have when the snow falls? Are you planning any colder weather versions? I imagine they're more challenging.
Yeah, exactly, yes. Yeah, I've actually been doing this for 10 years now, and for the first 9 years, we only had sandals, which made it really, really difficult to grow the business, of course, because for half the year, we are absolutely going insane with orders. We can't keep up at all. And then for the other half of the year, we, you know, don't have much money coming in. So it's really, it's very kind of like up and down, up and down. And it's hard to grow from there. So we did actually just last year start introducing closed-toed clogs and things like that. And then this year we do hope to have some kind of like clog booty sorts of shoes. And we'll continue to develop from there. But yeah, that definitely the sandals was a good launching point for creating our automated processes, just because, you know, as we were saying, closed-toed shoes are just way more complex. So to kind of come up with these systems that we're inventing, because we're making shoes the way nobody else has made shoes before. We're kind of reinventing the shoemaking wheel here. And so we just have to start with simpler shoes, and then as we kind of master new processes, then we can create more and more complex shoes. But it's definitely frustrating, for sure, in Chicago, like those first 9 years, and it'd be like a snowy day, and, you know, I tell somebody I make shoes, and they look down at my feet, and I'm like, oh, no, I didn't make these. So to be able to now that we have our clogs and stuff, I can... I have shoes that I can wear as long as there's not, like, 2 feet of snow on the ground. But looking forward to boots, for sure.
Well, I look forward to more small businesses. I don't think bigger is better. I think smaller is better in many cases. I don't like the word efficiency often when it's applied to businesses because of the exploitation that you spoke about earlier. We need to get back to smaller businesses that do things more in a custom way. All of us are individuals, but of course, it's going to be more expensive. And your shoes are pricier than what I can get in Payless, unfortunately, which probably exploits on so many levels, including environmental. And so I look forward to a day when we don't have to have like Amelia Marcus from the Philippines with a closet full of shoes. We have a collection of finely made shoes that are made to fit our feet from compassionate, conscionable businesses. I didn't say that right, but people who are thinking from the beginning to end about their product. That's my wish. And you're a part of that, so thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, we're definitely working toward that. I think it really is going to come down to kind of finding that balance between efficiency and production, but at like a local level. So it is really hard for small businesses to compete on price. So yeah, it's kind of, there are definitely more and more people who would rather pay $150 for a pair of shoes that's going to last them years than, you know, buying $30 pairs of shoes constantly. We're definitely seeing, seeing that in our customers. And it's really great, too. We've actually, we do a lot of, like, Pairs events, and we'll have customers come up and be like, I got a pair of your shoes 8 years ago, and I still wear them. And it's just...
Wow.
It's really fun to hear that, and it's great to know that that we're creating something that's, like, that durable. And, it's a great way to kind of keep customers, too, because when they come back, because they know that they're not going to have to, you know, be throwing those shoes in the garbage after wearing them, you know, a few miles.
Now, your shoes are vegan. There's no leather. And what's your reasoning for that?
So I actually grew up on a sheep farm and did, like, 4-H and all that stuff growing up, and was a real kind of farm girl. And I was never necessarily opposed to humans kind of using animals, just because on a very small farm, it was like our sheep were kind of part of our family, and it all was kind of presented as this, like, circle of life thing. And then when I got into college, I had a few friends who were becoming vegetarian, and I was like, that's crazy. Why would you do something like that? And just in kind of the spirit of, like, challenging them, I started doing research as to why somebody would become vegetarian, and I learned about factory farms, and I realized, like, oh, this, like, idyllic little farm that I grew up on is, like, not the norm at all whatsoever. And I became really horrified by the systems that I read about, so I went vegetarian. And a couple years later, went vegan. And so when I started the company, it wasn't necessarily that I wanted to start a specifically vegan shoe company. It was more like I wanted to make shoes, and then it, like, oh, by the way, they're vegan, they're eco-friendly, and all that stuff, just because those were my beliefs. And then it really started taking off from that standpoint, especially from the eco in sustainability realm. We launched in 2005, and in 2006, Al Gore's movie came out, Inconvenient Truth. And at the time, there really weren't any eco-friendly footwear companies. So all the, like, fashion magazines and stuff wanted to do stories on eco-fashion and wanted to put shoes in there. And if you Googled, like, eco-friendly shoes, ours were the first or second thing that came up. So that was kind of a great and a bad thing, and then it kind of launched us. We got a lot more popular than I could really handle, as at the time it was just me making shoes in the basement. But yeah, it's great to see that started becoming more popular, just because for me it was never ever a selling point for me that the shoes were vegan, that they were eco-friendly. It wasn't a marketing ploy whatsoever. It was just like, well, this is the right thing to do. Like, I just wouldn't feel like I could sleep at night running the business or having a product that was any other way.
It is an excellent marketing point.
Yeah, and so I was really lucky that the world kind of came around to my point of view in that regard.
Oh, gosh, I would love the world to come around to your point of view on every level. And hopefully we'll have more, I don't know, the fact that you're a woman entrepreneur, if it has anything to do with your decisions. But I'm definitely excited to see more women entrepreneurs and women businesses out there. And you won a few awards or grants for your business, and one of them was for being a woman woman-led business. I read in your bio what was that about?
Yeah, it's very exciting. So I started off, the business is really kind of a handcrafted business, and we couldn't keep up with demand. So I started incorporating more and more kind of automated technologies and kind of robots and those fun things. And in the last couple of years, we've been hearing a lot more about 3D printing and digital manufacturing. And so I felt like I could kind of come out of hiding and say, well, I use these sorts of technologies too, and this is scalable, and we can create like what will hopefully be a bigger company based around these principles of sustainability and custom manufacturing and all that stuff. So about a year and a half ago, I really kind of committed to creating a scalable company rather than just saying like artisanal and handcrafted. So it was really about creating something much bigger because I do believe that the whole system is broken. The whole mass production of footwear is awful. And I decided like, well, you know, it's the system isn't going to change until people come up with better ways of making things than our current mass production. And the big companies don't have any incentive to change the way they're doing things. So change is going to have to come from smaller companies who are really driving forward scalable changes in manufacturing technology. So I joined we have a startup accelerator and incubator here in Chicago and went through their program and learned a lot more about how to pitch my company and how to create a scalable, growth-oriented company. So after I graduated from that program, I started applying for various competitions and things like that, and we've done really, really well. Like I said, we've been on a couple different top 10 national lists for the work that we're doing, and now we're just about to embark on seeking funding for the business so that we can grow. One of my big concepts, you had mentioned local manufacturing and or you know local production, and that's one thing I'm really focused on is creating local mini factories. So instead of right now having like one big factory on the other side of the planet that's producing shoes by the tens of thousands, having mini local factories that are they're kind of like Starbucks in the way that Starbucks has kind of a palette of materials that they remix to make tons of different custom items. So we have kind of our palette of all sustainable vegan materials, and you can come into the store and have your foot scanned there, and the shoes can be made right there, in, you know, in an hour by our machinery. And you know, after you get a pair of shoes, we have your foot on file. So anytime in the future you'd like to order a pair of shoes, you need, you know, you decide that, you know, tonight's date night and I don't have the perfect pair of shoes. You can go online. We already have your foot on file and we make it at the local factory and, you know, send it over to you via drone or whatever system we have in place at that time. So, so instead of, it's kind of like decentralizing production, but still...
I'm loving this. I'm just loving this whole concept. Having your foot on file, it's just awesome. And I'm just so excited about what you're doing and hearing about your business process. Doesn't everybody want to give a big hand of applause to Annie Mohopt? I do. I think you're amazing. Thank you for what you're doing, and thanks for joining me today on It's All About Food, even though today it's all about shoes. So people can go to mohopt.com and look around, and you have free shipping. Is that correct?
Yes.
Free shipping. That's nice. And any kind of issues, I know that you have great customer service because that's what Robin told me.
Yeah, absolutely. So we will remake shoes. Like we have a full repair return policy. So if we make a pair of shoes for you and they don't fit perfectly, you can send them back for a full refund, or we can make any changes that you need to the fit. So what's most important to us is that each of our customers has like the best pair of shoes that they've ever had with our shoes, because that's how we grow, is people walking out on the street, and when people say like, oh my gosh, cute shoes, and they tell them about Mohopt.
Annie, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food today. All the best to you. And everyone, go to www.mohopt.com. Okay, be well.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, thank you. Okay, let's take like just a couple-minute break, and we'll be right back, and I'm going to welcome you to summer. Hey, everybody, we're back for the part two of today's program. Thanks for joining me. And it is indeed summer. Have you been looking at the moon? You know, this show is called It's All About Food. And I've heard different terms for the full moon a few days. Some have called it the strawberry moon and a honeymoon moon. And that's because the June full moon and the solstice fell just within hours of each other, and it was just a stunning, stunning, ripe, luscious moon. And that was just a beautiful way to bring in the summer. Okay, so the summer is here, and it's felt like summer for me for quite a while now because we're in the Bay Area in the Los Gatos area, Northern California, and it's pretty hot. And just, I mean, for example, this morning we went out for a walk at the Lexington County Park trails. There's a reservoir there, and there's some really wonderful trails. And when we do it, it takes about 2 hours up and down. I like to go earlier in the morning because it's not so hot, but it's still hot. And I come back, and all I want to do is hydrate, hydrate, hydrate. I had a mango, and then I just couldn't stop drinking it up. And this is a time in the hot weather. Now, some of you, you may be on the other side of the planet right now. It's not hot, okay? So just file this to listen to it when it is hot. But we really have to be careful to hydrate enough when we're in really hot weather. And so I thought I would talk about some fun ways to do that. So water is one way, right? But that water isn't really that much fun, except when you're parched and dry and all you can think about is drinking water. I know sometimes when I'm sleeping, I usually drink before I go to sleep. I usually have some sort of herbal tea or something. But sometimes, especially in the wintertime when the heat is on, the air is really dry, I can get really, really parched and I can dream about wanting to find water. I'm so parched. And then when I finally wake up, water is the best thing ever. But sometimes we want to spice it up a little, dress it up a little, color it up a little. And I know that most Americans have a habit of grabbing a Coke or a Sprite or a Fanta or some kind of extra sugary, colorful thing. And we know that's not really good for us, right? And yet there are some really wonderful things that we can do that are fun and fresh. So the first thing I wanted to talk about, and I just posted this on the responsibilityandliving.com website, are my version of aguas frescas. Aguas frescas. And this is a drink that's that you can find probably anywhere, but it's typically made from water and fruit, sometimes some grains and sugar. And I make mine very simply with fresh fruit. And I find melons are really good for the aguas frescas. Aguas frescas, for those of you who hablo español, means fresh waters. So I like to blend up like a whole watermelon, for example. I like to buy seeded watermelon. It's kind of a thing with me that fruits should have seeds. They're hard to find. It's probably easier to make this drink if you don't have seeds, but you can blend it up with the seeds too, especially if you have a Vitamix, or you can pick them out. And you can do this with cantaloupe or honeydew or any really ripe melon, scoop out the seeds and blend up the melon, and that's it. You can drink it. If you want, you could add a little sparkling water to it and dilute it a little bit, but just put it in a tall glass, add a sprig of mint, a straw, and you have a really fun, colorful, sweet, refreshing, so refreshing drink. And sometimes I like to make ice cubes out of this mixture too and put the blended melon or the blended fruit into an ice cube tray and then take them out when they're frozen. And then they make these wonderful, colorful cubes that you can put in a glass of sparkling water. And these are really fun, wonderful, fresh drinks. So check that out at responsibleeatingandliving.com. There's a recipe there, but you don't really need a recipe. Just blend up the fruit, pour it in a glass. And I like to add ginger juice or lemon juice or lime juice in addition. Sometimes that fruit sweetness is too sweet, so I like to cut it a little with something tart. And speaking of something tart, another great thing to make fresh summer rehydrating beverages is hibiscus. And I've had the opportunity to harvest some hibiscus and dry it and then peel away the leaves from the prickly parts of it that when it dries when I go down to Costa Rica and visit my friend's farm. But you can buy hibiscus. It comes in a tea bag sometimes, or you could buy it loose, or you can go to a country that grows it or grow it yourself. There are certain areas in the country where you can grow hibiscus. And these leaves, they're really good for you. They're full of vitamin C. I've heard that some people have actually made a veggie meat using the hibiscus leaves. They have a real nice chew to them. But you can just make a simple hibiscus tea with the leaves. It's caffeine-free. It's tart. It hydrates really well. That tartness really feels clean going down. And then if it's too tart, you can sweeten it with other fruits. You could mix it, for example, with one of these blended melons. But it has a great red color. I love that. You could also take some raisins, for example, or dates, some dried fruit, and soak them. And then the water that you've created from the dried fruit, you can mix with your hibiscus or other beverage. And it's a nice natural sweetener. And then you can still have the dried fruit to chew on. That's a bonus. another one that I want to remind you of, when I was talking to Dr. Michael Greger a few months ago, I guess it was the end of last year, December, when his new book, How Not to Die, came out. One of the things that he mentioned that really surprised me is if you make tea, like green tea, without boiling water, just putting the tea in cold water and just letting it sit overnight or for a number of hours, the tea will actually be more nutritious than if you brew it with boiling water. So here's a great drink. It's naturally cold. You can put a bunch of tea leaves in a container and let it go overnight. And then the next day you have iced tea, iced green tea, for example. You can do it with white tea. You can do it with black tea. Iced tea that actually has more health-promoting properties than if you brewed it hot. Something to keep in mind. I guess when people make sun tea, it's like that too, putting the tea and letting it brew out in the sun. Then it doesn't get too hot to destroy the nutrients. Yeah, so there's the hibiscus tea, the melon drinks, green iced tea, and then there's rooibos or red bush tea. Have you tried that yet? We drink that almost every night now as a non-caffeinated tea. Again, it has a great color, which makes it a great festive-looking beverage for the summertime. Lately, I've been drinking a mix from Teavana. It's here in the pool house that we're staying in. I didn't purchase it, and I wasn't even sure what it was because it was just in a plastic bag. But I looked it up online, and I'm pretty sure it's their Blueberry Bliss, which is rooibos combined with dried blueberries and raisins. And I thought, okay, in the future, I just may try a mix of rooibos with raisins and brew a tea like that. It's really, really delightful. And rooibos has also some excellent health-promoting properties. And it has a really nice flavor. It's a bit tart. But when you chill it, it makes a wonderful, wonderful beverage. So there you go. You have hibiscus tea, rooibos tea, green tea that's cold brewed, and then our aguas frescas. Agua frescas. Now, we're in the Bay Area, as I mentioned before, and as much as I want to prepare food at home where we are, we have an efficiency kitchen, and I'm grateful for that. It's not as easy to prepare food all the time because we don't have any pantry or any big storage. We're constantly going out buying food, which is kind of like the way people used to do it in the olden days, right? And some people still do it in other countries very often, and maybe there are some people who still do it here today and go out every day or every other day and buy the food that they're going to eat, and it's fresh. And but most of us are used to hoarding food, right, in our pantries. And anyway, we do go out a little more often while we're here. That was my point of all of this. And recently we discovered that Pinkberry has a few non-dairy items on their menu. And I couldn't help myself when I saw their non-dairy items. I immediately went into the store and said, what are the ingredients in these items? And so wonderfully, I was offered their product book. You could actually look at it online and you can see what the ingredients are in their products. So they had two particular ones available. One was a coconut, what did they call it? Coconut, I'm looking at their book right now. Coconut milk. They just called it a dairy-free coconut flavor. Okay, not a special name. And then they also had the Just Fruit Tropical Mango. So I love coconut, and I really wanted to try the coconut. And then I read the ingredients, and I'll read them to you. Water, organic coconut milk, thumbs up for that. Sugar, maltodextrin, dextrose, coconut milk powder, coconut milk powder. I said that, tapioca, maltodextrin, non-GMO corn starch and or coconut milk powder, which is coconut milk and tapioca syrup. I guess it's either or. Tapioca maltodextrin, that's a popular ingredient in this mix. Stabilizer, which consists of dextrose, guar gum, rice starch, stabilizer, locust bean flour, xanthan gum, maltodextrin, soy lecithin, more sugar, coconut flavor, which consists of coconut cream, cane sugar, filtered water, natural coconut flavor, fruit pectin, and titanium dioxide, little pinch of sea salt. Okay, in the grand scheme of things, this is not a horrible product. It's better than a lot of others out there, but it does have a lot of sugar and the gums, and I'm not particularly a fan of eating titanium dioxide. I don't know if you know this, but right out of college, I got my degrees in chemical engineering, and I went to work for DuPont making titanium dioxide. So I know how it's made, and I know what it does to you, and although it's approved to be put in food, I would really rather not consume it. It's not a terrible thing, and I like it in my sunscreens, but not in my food. Anyway, so I did get a taste sample of the coconut, but I ultimately went for the tropical mango because it's just made from mango puree, banana puree, white grape juice concentrate, pineapple juice concentrate, pear juice concentrate, natural flavor, citric acid, and water. It's true that the juice concentrates do make it a very sweeter product, and there's no added sugar, but fruit juice can be really, really sugary-like. So if you're looking to reduce sugar product, this is probably too sweet. But I'm glad it's there. I'm glad it's non-dairy. I'm glad it's vegan and made primarily from fruit purees. So on an occasional treat, you know, I can feel like everybody else in the summertime, going out and getting a nice colorful little swirl of something fresh and sweet and cold in a cup. But you know what? The best thing is when you make these types of desserts at home for yourself. And I resisted a long time getting a Vitamix, getting a high-powered blender. And I made a lot of things in my simple, inexpensive blender. And you can make a lot of wonderful fresh fruit smoothies that are cold and very fun to have in the summertime. You can add that to your list of these beverages I was talking about before. But I really got into making these soft serve desserts in the Vitamix, especially in the summertime. And we've got a bunch of different recipes at responsibleeatingandliving.com, but let me just throw a few out for you. One of my absolute favorites, and it's like the simplest thing to make, but you do have to plan in advance, and that's my orange creamsicle recipe, where you take oranges, peel them, and section them, and freeze them. And as soon as they're frozen, you can put them in your high-powered blender with some cashews and blend them up, add a little vanilla extract, and it's that wonderful vanilla orange cool flavor that I remember as a child when I used to eat dairy foods and I would get Good Humor ice cream. And I'm sure it's not exactly the same taste. I think it's a better taste, but it gives me that same happy memory with that vanilla orange creamy flavor. And then frozen strawberries make a wonderful ice cream. And again, you could make it light with like a sorbet, or you could make it heavier and richer. So if you're just making it like a sorbet, you just blend up strawberries with some water. You can add some other frozen fruits to it if you want. If you want to make it creamier, you could add frozen bananas. If you want to make it richer, you can add some cashews. And these make the most wonderful soft serve frozen ice cream treats. And I like to add some plain unsweetened cocoa powder too to my strawberry mixes sometime, or my banana mixes, and gives it a chocolatey flavor. And you can do this at home if you're having a barbecue outside. This is a really fun dessert to make with everybody, the kids and the grown-up kids, because everybody likes ice cream. And it's fun when you make it yourself. I used to always like bringing out that old wooden churning ice cream maker. But I guess I've gotten lazy, and I'm going with all non-dairy fruit products that I blend in my Vitamix. Some other restaurants that we've been visiting while we've been here. Have you heard of Life Kitchen? L-Y-F-E, Life Kitchen. There's a bunch of them, and they have an interesting history. So they were started by a couple guys, executives from McDonald's, who left McDonald's and wanted to come up with some healthier, more environmentally friendly foods. Now, Life Kitchen is not vegan, but they consulted with Chef Tal Ronan, who's a wonderful vegan chef, and he created the vegan items that are on the Life Kitchen menus. And they have a bunch of locations. I think they're all in California. Let's see here. I'm looking at their website now. It's L-Y-F-E Kitchen, lifekitchen.com. Oh, they've got them in Colorado, and Texas, and Tennessee, and Evanston, Illinois. I didn't know that. Did you? Chicago, Illinois? Wow, there's a lot of them. That's good to know. Well, I just went to my first one the other day, and Gary got a burger, which was amazing. And I got some soup. I wasn't really very hungry, but I wanted to try something, so I got this broccoli potato soup. And we'll be going back on Saturday to try their brunch items. So Life Kitchen is fun because they clearly label the food with the letter E is for people who eat everything, the omnivores. And then they have V for vegan, and then they have gluten-free. And they also let you know there are nuts in the product. So this is another exciting fast food place. It's counter service to look for in your travels. And I thought it was pretty awesome. Now, another thing I wanted to mention, I mentioned the burger at Life Kitchen. Excuse me. It's going to be barbecue time in the summer, right? And you need some great things to put on the barbecue as a vegan. Lots of great vegetables go great on the barbecue. You can think of potatoes, sweet potatoes. Just wrap them up. You can sit them in the coals, and they cook very well. And corn does really great on the barbecue. But we have some veggie burgers for you. And my most favorite veggie burger is the, what did I call that burger? Oh my goodness, I'm forgetting the name of the burger. It's on my homepage. I have to look it up. But it's made from black rice and red rice. It has a really lovely, lovely chewy consistency. And you can prepare them in advance, and then you can bring them with you to a barbecue. I call them the Healthy World Burger. And we have some wonderful side sauces that you can make, a chipotle sauce, although I just saw Just Mayo has their chipotle sauce, which is fun to get if you're looking for something really quick and easy to bring along on a barbecue or a picnic or something like that. So check out our burger recipes, especially the Healthy World Burger. It is an awesome burger, and I hope you put it on a grill sometime really, really soon. And, burgers. Oh, and don't forget, fruit is great on the barbecue, too. You can put a little, like, balsamic vinegar on it or something, a little light marinade, and barbecue strawberries and peaches and nectarines. They're awesome on the barbecue, so don't forget them. Plant foods are great at barbecues, and we don't need any of those other fleshy things that most people seem to think of when they think of a barbecue. But we need to change that, because plant foods are best on the barbecue, and they go really well with potato salad and kale salads and other wonderful plant salads. Okay, it's summertime, and I wanted to leave you with a song, and so I'm going to do that. This is from Porgy and Bess, and it's me singing Summertime. So have a delicious week, and here's the song.